It doesn't.
Welcome to Radio Syntax, the offshoot of our 8-year literary music and art publication, Denver Syntax. You can find our hundreds of stories and reviews on local music, art, and literature at www.denversyntax.com. And just as we have done over the 8 years with Syntax, we are again reaching out to find those stories that impact us, that we find intriguing, the stories that we think best describe the kind of creature that we actually are, what's inside of us, where did we come from, and really, what are we made of? After all, wrapped inside of every story is the story of humanity. For this episode, we're going to take a look at one Colorado family and explore their story, their descent into mental illness, their subsequent resurfacing, and triumph. For while this story begins with just one person, a Denver painter named Jordan Kanjar, this ends up being the story about an entire family, the entire Kanjar family, his father, his mother, his sister, and relatives at large. Really, since the dawn of humanity, humans have been dealing with mental illness, their afflictions, their upsides, and their low sides. I myself have dealt with my own share of dysphoric depression. I've seen how it's affected my family and the loved ones around me. For years, I've been obsessed about the correlation between badness and creativity and really what's just beautiful about mental illness. And while I found some tenuous correlations, some people that believe in madness driving them to beautiful places, we're going to take a very different look at mental illness, and how one Colorado family found it sneak up on them and face them in a literal death match. In all, this isn't a romantic story. This isn't Van Gogh cutting off his ear, or an artist going mad over a girl. This is a story about just how severe mental illness can be. And while it can push you to the edge of any conception of mortality, yours or those around you, it can also lift you up. It can oddly change everything for the better and give you a different conception about what life is altogether. The tale is a bit graphic, and it is a bit sensational, but, again, it is a very human tale. And while the story doesn't necessarily start where we are going to begin, for every story has a backstory and a history, in a period where all the foreshadowing presents itself, we're going to begin the story with that one phone call that nobody ever wants to get. Here, to begin, is Jordan's mother, Allison Kanjar.
When we got home, there was a call from Denver Health, and they said, "We have your son here, and you need to get down here." And that was all they told us. So we drove down there and...
And she and her husband waited in the emergency room. In some regard, they were kind of quarantined. Something certainly didn't feel right, and it wasn't just that their son Jordan was in the emergency room. Things seemed a little bit off. So they sat there and waited for somebody to come get them.
When someone finally did come, it was a police officer and a woman. And they told us to follow them, and they took us back through these halls into like a conference room, and they asked us if there was anyone who would have wanted to hurt Jordan. And we were like, "No, you know, what is going on?" And then they finally told us that Jordan had cut his throat and his wrists, and then they told us that he had cut his penis off.
And thus began the biggest shock of the Kanjar's life. Certainly you can imagine that they were stunned. Now they knew why they were in the emergency room, but why was Jordan? What brought him here? How could something so horrific happen? And what is anybody really supposed to think? You don't practice for these scenarios.
I just remember Phil yelling, and I just brought my hands up to my face. And I guess it was just shocking, and we just couldn't believe it, and were so confused and didn't know why he would have done that. And then the thought ran through my mind, oh my God, everyone's going to think I did something to this kid that made him do this. And how am I even going to go in the emergency room and see him? And then these thoughts went through your mind just so fast. And I thought too, we're never going to be able to tell anyone. Like, we're going to have to live with this just us alone. And then something else kicked in, and it was not about me anymore. The woman that was there was a social worker, and she mentioned, I think that was the first anyone mentioned schizophrenia, that this was something that happens. And we had never even in our wildest dreams imagined that something like this could happen. Then they took us to see Jordan, and he was awake. And I remember it being so hard to say to him, everything's going to be okay, you know, because I had no idea if everything was going to be okay or not.
And so, through the chaos, they were narrowing it down. They finally had a word, schizophrenia. Wasn't a pretty word, but it's a prettier word than dead and goodbye. It was a place for them to start. Soon after Phil and Allison Kanjar made it to the hospital, their daughter Taylor arrived. And so, we'll lean on her to also fill in the blanks about this story and her experiences, and really, how she, alongside her family, began to unravel this and put together the puzzle to make sense of it all. The word that they began with was schizophrenia.
It was kind of an answer, in a way, so it was kind of a little bit of closure for what had been going on. Why did he do this to himself, you know? With what he did, I mean, that's just mind-boggling in itself. So to at least know that it was because he has this illness was, in a way, kind of a relief. But then you have this whole other side of it. You know, what does that mean? And what is his life going to be like now?
Just as much as Jordan's family wanted to know what the rest of his life was going to be like and his prognosis and what schizophrenia meant, what had already happened was equally important and perhaps even more telling.
And those questions really weren't answered for a long time. While he was in the hospital, the first thing we were really concentrating on was kind of getting his body better and getting his mind better.
From that moment on was our journey back to recovery. And he was over a week in the ICU and slowly kind of coming back to us. And we just showered him with love and were there with him all the time. And our relatives came and our friends and everybody showed up and was there for us. And then he spent a month in the regular hospital recovering from his injury, and he had a couple more surgeries. And that whole entire month, that kid had to lay flat on his back and couldn't even lay on his sides, which I don't know how he did it.
Jordan's hospital stay over those 30 days proved to be profound and really prophetic. These were days that the family would later learn were incredibly rare and they would grow increasingly grateful for. In a strange way, there were days filled with light. Recalling those days, Jordan even thinks of them fondly sometimes. This, despite the fact that there was one other S-word that was about to creep into the family's life. Another S-word, besides schizophrenia. A possible culprit and reason for why the family was in the hospital at all right now, and why Jordan was laying on his back for these 30 days. That word, just as scary as schizophrenia in a lot of regards, was suicide. When you couple those two S-words together, certainly they compound themselves, and the disbelief grows exponentially. But, as it turns out, there is rhyme and reason within all of this, and that's mostly on account of the fact that it's Jordan himself that has an incredibly unique view on all of this. A playful one. A creative one. After all, it is his story, and his painting here. Jordan is affable, he's creative, and, as you're about to learn, he's incredibly articulate. So, let's bring in the grand puzzle decipherer to this tale, the hero, Jordan Kanjar.
Everything that happened in the suicide attempt was not a decision I made or a decision anyone made. It was an accident. And it happened in the same sense that a plane falls from the sky. Certainly, there was probably a problem before takeoff or something like that, but what actually caused it to happen was completely arbitrary. It's as if it landed on me from outer space.
They say that schizophrenia is inherited genetically. Unbeknownst to Jordan and Taylor at that time, Allison Kanjar's family had a decent history of some mental illness, from dysthymic depression all the way up to schizophrenia, something that one of Allison's cousins had suffered from. So, while it did seem like it fell out of the sky for the entire family, and that day when they were in that hospital, it came from somewhere, and it manifested in its own unique way, through Jordan, because of Jordan. And so we'll back up, not all the way to Allison's family, but to a couple years prior, when Jordan was growing up as an adolescent in Colorado.
I think that a major trigger for me was this looming insecurity of a sexual nature. I believed that I really didn't have anything to give anyone, that I was a freak and too weird to be accepted. I thought I had the worst fate because I had graduated high school without being kissed.
Jordan then went on to go to school in the city, to college, where he branched out socially and was moving through his adolescence towards adulthood. Still, there were a couple themes riding alongside him.
I was still a virgin and went off and got into extremely painful crushes. I ripped myself apart over a few girls. I think that that and the pot was probably the things that triggered the onset the most. But I must also emphasize that the science actually supports that it would probably be more accurate to say that those weren't triggers. Those would actually be more symptoms of the mental illness. I think that's a very important thing to emphasize, actually.
As is the case for most of us, finding yourself when you're 18 or 19 years old is incredibly tricky. The slopes are slippery, they bank steeply, and things can sway from one way to another very quickly. Life is a little bit delicate in these years. But for Jordan, they were a little bit different, and a little bit more slippery. Which galaxy are you from? How's it looking at night? Night! Out, frozen with
fright. Fright. Out, you are not mine. So I had all of these hopes and expectations to go off to college and sort of experience freedom and be myself and learn things that I was really interested in finally. And I felt so bogged down and even degraded by my peers that I stopped going to school and began smoking a lot of pot. Part of that was peer pressure. I thought pot was a really cool thing and smoking it would make me more sociable. And I also quickly developed a complex about smoking pot, because I thought that pot made good artwork. And it certainly drove emotional aspects of drawings and stuff. But the problem with it was there was a lot of stuff in between that was just false starts and half-baked.
We knew he was smoking pot, and we knew it was probably more pot than he should be, and we would, of course, have conversations about that. But he ended up moving out and quitting his job with that friend and moving in with some new kids, and they were from Japan. And so there was a communication problem with them, with us, and he was taking care of it. You know, he found these kids and he again got a new job, but pretty soon he quit his job again. And we were sort of confused by his behavior. And that was kind of the first indication, you know, little red flags are going up and you're kind of like, what's going on? You know, is this, how much of this is pot smoking? How much of this is just his age and he's rebelling? And you're really pretty confused as a parent. Our whole thing is about our kids' independence. So we were really leaning towards operating with him in that regard.
At this point, the red flags were flying up everywhere. And again, the Kanjars trusted Jordan in his decision-making and his aptitude to be an adult and make the right decision. But Jordan was too close to the problems to see them. Stemming from his internal struggle with the external world, small psychoses began to occur.
There was a girl that I basically fell in love with immediately. And I would, at the time, walk around Denver a lot because I didn't have a bus pass and the bus was kind of expensive. I would look at address numbers on people's houses and literally start doing arbitrary random math that somehow told me that she was my soulmate. And it only gets weirder from there.
And the cycle of the external world battling with Jordan's internal world continued. And, as a result, he medicated himself because of it. Subsequently, this battle, the cycle, began to rotate faster and faster.
I think pot really helped me lose my mind. There was another drug experience. I actually tripped mushrooms, and that was definitely a catalyst for absurd behavior and also delusion. A week after I tripped mushrooms, I was in the hospital because I more or less didn't understand the English language anymore. When I tripped mushrooms, I tripped with some Japanese kids and thought that I discovered the esoteric nature of language, and everything became coded, and everything you would say became extremely literal. So a really sort of funny literal thing was whenever someone said Jesus fucking Christ, I thought of Jesus masturbating. I didn't like it when I was crazy, but that's what I would think of. It became strange and incognitive.
And one of these days, to Jordan's parents' delight, he has to spend the day with them. And so they did. They went to the zoo, spent time eating and talking. But there were these moments when Jordan would sort of disappear cognitively. He would go away, sort of space out. It didn't concern the Kanjars too much because, as they always knew, Jordan was a thinker. He was prone to introspection. So the red flags didn't necessarily raise at that moment, even though they thought it was a little bizarre, his actions. At this point, mental health, mental illness was not a part of any equation that the Kanjars could conceive of, so it just wasn't in the arena of possibility. And so, after an altogether good day, the Kanjars took Jordan back to his apartment. Then, something a little abnormal happened.
Got a call in the morning from his roommate saying Jordan wanted to come home, and, you know, we were like, what do you mean? Why isn't he calling us? And so Phil went over and got him. And when they arrived at home, Jordan was unable to even speak coherently. And I guess he'd been pretty combative with Phil in the car. And I called a neighbor who's a psychiatrist and asked her, you know, Jordan's not making sense. What should we do? We didn't even know, what do you do with this kid? And she said, take him to the emergency room, and she works at Children's Hospital, so we took him there, and he was just crying and then laughing, and just, it was almost like he couldn't speak coherently, and we were terribly confused and frightened, and we spent the whole day there, and his sister came as well, and
I think schizophrenia did come up at one point, but was kind of pushed aside, and I remember we were almost hoping that it was a blood clot in his brain more so than him having schizophrenia, because they're both scary, but schizophrenia is so unknown, it's just even worse.
It was just super frightening, and I don't know, I got this weird vibe from the staff. They would make kind of little comments about him that led me to believe they weren't really sympathizing with his plight, yet they took him in. You know, they took him into the ER and were examining him. Then finally a psychiatrist came hours after we'd been there and interviewed him and sent us out of the room. And when we came back, she said, well, he's admitted to doing, taking mushrooms. But it had been a week previous, and so we were kind of confused about that. Like, why wouldn't he have had this reaction as he was high? And they said, well, a drug-induced psychosis can last, you know, weeks. Or they told Jordan they wanted to observe him overnight, and he got a little combative. So they put him in a room and suggested one of us be there with him through the night. And they had a security guard outside the door. Jordan finally woke up, and a whole new doctor came in and just said, well, we're releasing Jordan, and he seems calmed down now, and said, you need to just take him home and not bring him back here again. If this happens again, take him to a different hospital. He's too old to be treated here. And the previous doctor had said, we'll help you, you know, find a psychiatrist to take him to. And this new doctor was unwilling to help me at all and said, your insurance, you know, you can contact your insurance, get online and find a doctor that way. So I took Jordan home, and he was still not acting right. And I just got on the phone, and it took me hours to finally even get a hold of someone. A doctor called me back and said, I can actually see you this week, which was 3 days from that day. And all the others were either no new patients, or I can't see him for a month or two, I'm traveling, or I, you know, what have you. So that was extremely frustrating. I ended up calling him back like an hour or two later because Jordan's behavior was escalating again. And he just called in a medication without ever even having seen Jordan.
Now, I don't know if you've ever been in this situation. It is all too common, however. You're desperate for assistance while somebody close to you is in a psychotic throe, but there's nowhere to go. Help is limited and elusive. Who do you call? Or, if you're in the Kanjar situation, who will answer? Who will call you back? You can break your arm or need stitches, and it's pretty simple where you go. You go to the ER. With mental illness, it's entirely different. You can go to the ER, but you're not going to get help immediately. And what that help is sometimes ambiguous at best. And why I remark here is because this is a terrifying place to be. But you tell me, what else do you do? Especially when you don't know what is going on in somebody else's head. In all, these kinds of moments are really a testament to the profundity and complexity of the human brain.
We just kind of kept feeding him these pills, calming him down, and then got him in that Thursday. And Jordan didn't really connect very well with the guy. And he interviewed my husband and I about Jordan and how he'd been as a child. And I think to his credit, we probably came across, I know my husband by that point was so frustrated with Jordan and we didn't even understand anything about mental illness. So he was saying, oh, Jordan's been just uncooperative and a problem and defiant and doesn't want to work. And anyway, through numerous meetings with us and a few with Jordan, he finally told us that he thought Jordan was just being manipulative and that we needed to engage in tough love with him or it would just continue like this. So by then, I mean, Jordan had the classic symptoms, which I know now, which was the not bathing, and he would just get really violent with me, yelling and screaming at me and swearing at me, and you just couldn't even be around him, and you got angry with him. He was awful to be around. So we did what the doctor suggested, and we cut Jordan off from his rent money, and of course, his roommates kicked him out, and we were prepared to see him, you know, out on the streets, but he called and asked if he could come home.
And so, the Kanjars were left with the diagnosis that they received, that Jordan possibly had a split personality disorder. And the prognosis wasn't good. He could end up on the street because of his petulance and insolence, not because of any lingering mental illness. Simply put, nobody saw the profound changes going on inside of Jordan. It was at this point that Jordan's descent into madness really began to pick up speed. Even by his own account, there was a threshold that had been crossed.
The time that I would diagnose myself as mentally ill would have started clearly in the spring of 2008. So that only really gave me a year of being mentally ill. Before that, I think I was emotional and perhaps not completely rational, but cognitive and capable of taking care of myself. And I also started thinking that my uncle was my father. And I brought my parents to therapy one day and said that in front of them. And the weird thing was that I honestly believed it. They were delusions. They weren't hallucinations yet. But I think I took up a very strong religious feeling. And I say feeling because I don't know if it was a belief exactly. I feel like I didn't really believe anything until I tripped mushrooms. I was just sort of wandering, picking up ideas and trying them out in my head. But I did definitely feel a profound sense of godliness. Not necessarily that I was a god, but that I was doing God's work with my artwork. And I thought smoking pot was a really spiritual thing, and listening to music was a very spiritual thing.
It should be of note to point out that Jordan did not grow up in a religious family, so any notions of the spiritual and of religion and religious figures were purely had by himself. They were concoctions of his own cognitive constructs. Interestingly, Jordan's sense of the spiritual and of the religious was yoked together by his art and by music.
I listened to a lot of hip-hop, and that, I think, played a very integral role in a lot of delusions I had because of how much I would listen to music. I feel like that was really the only media that I consumed, and I interpreted it as Word of God.
A good example of this was a song that Jordan found by RZA called Terrorism. In that song, RZA talks about rhinos.
Sort of became very interested in spirit animals after tripping mushrooms. And I believed I was two different animals because I'm a Gemini. And I believed that was really important. And the two animals that I believed I was a moth and a rhino. And I chose those two because they sort of represent dynamic opposites. As legend goes, and I've done research on it, rhinos are said to put flames out. They would come to your campsite and put the flame out with their feet. The thing about moths was that moths are attracted to flame. So I believed I was the flame seeker, like more or less a spiritual firefighter to put flames out. That's just one example of what music taught me. There was another really good example is in the album Danger Doom by MF Doom and Danger Mouse. There's a song on that album where he says something to the effect of the old king's done been busted. And I believed myself to be a half-breed between good and evil, and that made me okay. The word okay. I was not good nor bad. I was just okay. I think I got that in my head because I also thought the word okay meant old king, which was the lyric. And that sort of spawned this whole series of delusions in and of itself. It's funny because I look back really and I see even my delusions had delusions.
By now, you can paint the picture of Jordan wandering the streets of Denver by himself with his headphones on, swimming in an entirely different world than his friends were, his family were. And by his own admission, he kept an odd sort of company.
Another aspect of being delusional is getting into sometimes abusive relationships, actually. I had a lot of friends at the time who were definitely not my friends because they didn't have either the sympathy or maybe even the insight to understand that something was dramatically wrong with what was going on in my head. But to be honest, I think that I was naturally attracted to people like that because I could hide myself and not be criticized for my faults in those situations. Another unfortunate fact of mental illness. I know that I was driving away my family because I didn't want them to see me like that. I didn't want them to think I was a drug addict and a deadbeat and a shame. And it was all the more complicated, too, because I believed my artwork was godsend, of course. I mean, many of my delusions were centered around martyrdom, but art sort of became this interesting avenue to explore because I believed it would be my immortal vessel. It would become me in time. I believed there was a particular painting that I made where I believed that it would have my eyes and that as people looked at it, I would be able to stare back at them. And for as long as the painting existed, I would not be reincarnated. And it would be me guarding Earth, and people could come meet me, and I would look back at them. Which is still a very beautiful image, I think. I think that if you look at mental illness historically, we may, in all actuality, have been the people that created the religions of time past and today. People believed us because there's some actual semblance of fact. And if not fact, then poetry. For all that we go through, we have some semblance of truth in a very bizarre way. For me was to escape this nest of overclocked and naked wranglers, steel skeletons and cast symbols reflected in purple goyas, indigent grandfathers with crying hands. Might be best to escape but west of. Things got nightmarish at a certain point, and it happened very quickly. After tripping mushrooms, there were about 4 or 5 months that I felt like Jesus. I was doing God's work. I was going to die for everyone's sins. I was saving the world. I was going to reunite everyone with their family. And then it sort of took a wrong turn at some point, which I think was inevitable, because for as much magic as I had and was pushing out into the world to do these things, I was also seeing that there was no end result to any of this activity. So naturally, I think that I began to blame myself for all bad things in the world and began to believe that I was the devil. But I was a very tricky kind of devil. I was not the devil you normally think of. I dubbed myself the devil in white, which was the origin of sin, or the origin of immorality. And this character ultimately was so misled because it told itself a lie and forgot that lie. So now, as it walks the earth being good, it inevitably does bad because of this lie. And that was very key, I believe, in the decision I made to kill myself. Because I had it in my mind that if I died that day, I would finally learn how I lied to myself. I would finally figure out what I told myself before I was born or at a very young age that made me such an atrocity of dishonesty. Before the suicide attempt, I spent a few weeks listening to voices in my head, which is another very interesting aspect of mental illness, because they're yourself. You are actually talking to yourself, and you put all the words in their mouth. And that's a very, very dangerous entity, because they know your weaknesses, and they know your insecurities. And inevitably, you will have to face that aspect of yourself when you are on that path. I actually started believing from these voices that I had killed people. That's when it became very clear to me that I needed to end my life, to stop doing damage to the earth. And it started with ridding myself of the earth, and that meant burning my artwork.
He went to his new job, which was bussing tables on a Saturday, and came home early that afternoon and was super agitated and angry and just started grabbing all his art and took it out to the yard and started burning it. You know, when I would approach him to talk to him about it or, you know, ask him what was wrong or please stop, he would just scream and yell at me and tell me, leave me alone. I just want a new beginning. And so I called his dad and his dad came home and he was able to talk to him. So Phil took him for a big walk. I think we ate dinner and they went for a walk. And Jordan was still doing that sort of spacing out and not responding when you talked to him again.
The voices kept coming and I couldn't hear a thing that he was saying. I was so catatonic at that point that I was so in my own head. I couldn't hear anything.
And they were gone for hours and came home and Phil said that he thought Jordan had calmed down and was okay.
And I picked up a razor blade from the basement and had a spot in mind where I would end my life.
It was really late and we wanted to go to bed, so we said goodnight to Jordan and he hugged Phil and told Phil he loved him. And then he hugged me goodnight, but he didn't say he loved me. So in the back of my mind, I thought, it's okay, you know, he's not going to do anything to himself because he didn't say he loved me. And we went to bed and I heard him start to go out the door and I called out, Jordan, what are you doing? And he said, nothing. I said, are you going somewhere? And he said, no, I'm not. And then I heard him go to his bedroom. We went to sleep. And when we woke up in the morning, he wasn't there.
It was clear across the other side of town. And it was my walk. It was my day to die. And I took my time when I walked and I considered the life I had and I made it there and began to cut my wrists. And I did that for a few hours actually. And it was painful. It was. I even made it deep enough to cut a tendon. Luckily, I made the mistake of cutting the wrong way. It formed a blood clot. I think I lost a decent amount of blood that way, but obviously not enough to die. And then I started cutting my throat and kept missing the jugular. I went pretty deep though, and still have a scar there. And then a voice popped in my head, a voice that had an unbelievable, terrifying power over me. It sounded like a mobster from fucking hell. It was gnarly. And he said to me that we changed your body overnight. You can't kill yourself by cutting your wrists or your throat, because that would be too easy. And bear in mind, I was doing this fully expecting to go to hell after I died. And I believed that this moment would define my honor. The lie that I told myself was going to come to me, and even if it meant an eternity of endless emotional and physical pain, I would know myself, finally. And he said to me, you have to cut off your penis and testicles to die. So I set myself up for doing that task and immediately got to work. There are some seriously gruesome details to doing that that I think no one should really know. So at the end of it, I was sort of like, great, now I can just sort of sit here and die. And I began feeling this feeling of death impending. Cold becomes warm. I didn't see a tunnel or anything like that. I didn't see a white light. But I did feel this fluttering sensation, this sort of noise. But I saw it too. And it was as if someone was hitting a cymbal or a very large gong. But the gong was me. I was the gong. And I was vibrating. And then a voice said, okay, now that that's done, it's time to get started on your fingers and toes. And I just passed out. That I didn't go into shock is ridiculous. But that's because I was insane. I didn't feel my body. I had a voice enter my head again, and it was a stranger I met on the bus, and I didn't exactly get along with this guy. And he said to me, congratulations. You get to live. You get to be 93. As that dickless, ballless freak you always wanted to be. And I sort of said to myself, well, that's good enough for me. And I picked myself up, and I put my pants back on, which was a feat. And I began walking to the road that was somewhat nearby. And I fell over a few times on the way over there, and began to scream. But I had lost so much blood and was so weak that my scream was this horrifically weak scream. I remember the feeling of it coming out of my mouth, and I had no strength to even make noise. But it became clear that no one was hearing me either. So I picked myself up again and walked out to the street, and there were three or four strangers walking down the street, and I sort of waved to them and then just fell over. Go through that and then re-emerge with medication and come back to what one might call sanity is a very, very confusing endeavor. And I think that it's as if I have two people in my head with me. There's sort of a schism between us as well. We disagree about things, and it's okay though. I think I've made peace with whoever else is in there.
We've had a pretty amazing outcome. One of the renowned schizophrenia experts in Denver came and interviewed Jordan and told us he thought Jordan was severely ill. And when he was in the hospital, no one could tell us what to expect or what to do to make the outcome better. They just said, you know, it depends on whether he responds to medication or not, and kind of up to him. And it took a lot of us kind of bothering the doctors for them to finally tell us about NAMI, which is a great organization. And I mean, he had been in the hospital over a month before anyone even mentioned NAMI, which I think that the first visit with the first break, we should have been given a pamphlet about these there are many organizations out there. People should know about them, and people should know about mental illnesses before this happens to them or a loved one, because there's a good chance it can and it will. I think the number is, I believe it's 1 out of 4 have a severe mental illness. There's a lot of families out there dealing with this all alone. I don't know. I think we so casually and easily talk about crazy people, and they're kind of an easy group to judge. And then when you have a personal experience, you learn a lot really fast about it and how unfair it is and how it can happen to anybody. It is a brain disease. I also kind of have a problem with our calling, especially the major illnesses like schizophrenia and bipolar, mental illnesses, because I think mental illness kind of connotates that they have some control, or it can be talk therapy can help, which is absolutely not true. They have to have medication. It's a chemical imbalance, and I think that they might receive more of the respect and sympathy they deserve if we were to call them brain diseases or brain illnesses, because it's an organ like any other. I thought before this happened, I had a lot of empathy for others, and I learned really fast that there was a lot of room for improvement.
So, while we shared Jordan's story in whole, I don't think it was too sensationalistic to share so many details and to give you such a large sampling of his delusions and psychosis. For me, it's like the first time that I read William Styron's Darkness Visible. It brought me just that much closer to a shared grief or an understanding of what mental health, or in this case, what schizophrenia is, and more than that, really what the human mind can do, how it can go off the rails, and what it can produce. In this last part, we're going to get a little metacognitive and explore the importance of Jordan's story and what it illuminates about mental health and what it shows us about other schizophrenics. Because when it comes to mental health, we're still in a bit of a dark age. Funding is limited, knowledge is predicated on stereotypes and is incredibly watered down, and perceptions are based mostly in fear. For while there are the bad stories, the horrific ones, there are also multitudes of people a bit like Jordan, creative, thoughtful, playful. And this is why we thought it was important to share Jordan's story, because it illuminates the beauty of human cognition, its ups and downs, for sure. But also, as you saw with Jordan, even in darkness, it paints a picture of the human brain's aptitude for poetry and creation, and even the synthesis of many ideas which we call knowledge. But mostly, if nothing else, we hope that this story breaks down some of the walls, some of the stereotypes, some of the fear around mental health, around schizophrenia. We wanted to bring in a professional here to clarify common misconceptions and really further our conversation here about mental health and really schizophrenia. And so we welcome David Burgess, the founding executive director of CHARGE, the Capitol Hill Action and Recreation Group.
CHARGE serves adults who have various types of severe and persistent mental illness. I'd say schizophrenia is probably our most common diagnosis, but we also treat people with bipolar illness, major depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, certain personality disorders. The common thread is not necessarily the diagnosis, but it's the fact that these are people whose mental illness is significant enough that it's keeping them from being able to function without a certain level of support, so they can't necessarily hold down full-time jobs or be as independent as they might like to be. We have a number of programs. We have a drop-in center that's open to anyone with a major mental illness who wants to come, as long as they're relatively stable and not disruptive. And then we also have a 50-person comprehensive mental health clinic. And we have a third program, which is a cooperative project with the Coalition for the Homeless, which works with homeless people who are mentally ill and helps them find housing and connect with benefits and other kinds of services that they need.
What the CHARGE story really spoke to is the idea of education and assessment. Mental health is a tricky thing. It's hard to locate, and then once you do locate an issue, it's hard to pinpoint exactly what that is. And more than that, it's hard to diagnose it and get somebody on the proper medication and treatment plan. Mental health, and schizophrenia in particular, is finicky. It's a trickster. So, we wanted to get a good handle on a definition of schizophrenia. So we asked David, what is schizophrenia?
Well, schizophrenia is in itself kind of an umbrella term that encompasses a number of different types of symptoms. So I don't think you would find very many people with that diagnosis who satisfy all of the criteria that you would find in the what's called the DSM-4. A number of them have one or another symptom of psychosis. You have some that have what are called negative symptoms, meaning that their affect is pretty flat. They don't get up for a lot of things. They seem to not always respond to stimuli as quickly as someone without schizophrenia would. And then you have a number of others who have what are called positive symptoms, which would range from hearing voices, having paranoid delusions, having what are called ideas of reference, which means thinking that something in the outside world has some special significance for them, like watching television and thinking that they're getting a special message that's really designed just for them, or thinking that people can read their minds, that kind of thing. It's really a very disorienting and sometimes frightening experience for people who are in the throes of something like schizophrenia. What characterizes and makes schizophrenia and also bipolar illness a little bit different is that it's been demonstrated that they have a genetic component. So life stresses do play a part in sometimes triggering the onset of a mental illness. But there also seems to be an inherited genetic factor that makes you more susceptible.
Again, one of the biggest issues here is that of education. But it's not just with the general public. It's with the mental health industry itself. For, if you listen within the Kanjar story, they had some of the same concerns that I've had with the mental health industry. It seems like these mental health professionals are just guessing, that it's experimentation. They're going on a whim and hypotheticals. Nothing feels concrete and rounded. And as a result, what people are left with is what the Kanjars were left with, a bit of resentment. But fortunately, their resentment was laced with a lot of luck.
I mean, Jordan spent the first month in a regular bed in a private room, and that was great. And he was doing amazingly well. And then they put him in the psych ward for a week. It was very, very different. You know, he was in a room with absolutely nothing, and we couldn't go in his room, and the visitation was limited. And we believe strongly that had he not injured himself the way he did and been put in the psych ward, the outcome we've had wouldn't be the same, because we wouldn't have had the chance to develop that trust with him. And so while that injury was hideous and just horrible, it was our saving grace. It's what saved Jordan. Got him extra care, sympathy, understanding.
You know, the system certainly has not uniformly done a great job with mental illnesses. And part of that results from the fact that we're still learning about them. The research budget for mental illnesses is a small fraction of the amount of funding that goes toward researching physical illnesses like cancer, arthritis, those kinds of things. I feel like the level of understanding of mental illness is at the point now where we have a number of remedies that we know are effective with many people much of the time, but we don't have any across-the-board remedy that we know will work for everybody. For example, there are physical infections that we know will respond well to penicillin, unless someone happens to be allergic to penicillin. We know what's going to happen when we administer that drug in the absence of an allergy. Whereas with schizophrenia, there are a dozen different medications, and a good psychiatrist will have a reason to make a judgment that one medication may work better than another. But until you administer the medication and begin to observe its effect, it's difficult to say whether that's the best choice or not. Sometimes we only learn by trying one med, finding out that it either doesn't seem to affect the symptoms well enough, or maybe it takes care of the symptoms, but it also makes the person so drugged up that they're really sedated and unable to be effective and unable to really live their lives very easily. So that's not good either. I would say in general, the objective of any good psychiatrist is to find the medication that is most effective and that has the fewest adverse side effects, and then to get the patient on the lowest effective dose of that medication, so that the person is able to carry on with his or her life and is not dealing with too many side effects, because the side effects of medications, as I'm sure you know, are an unfortunate price that we have to pay for using them.
And we'll close on this last point here and have David Burgess really finish it off. Medication is tricky. It's based on the diagnosis, and the prognosis is really contingent on that medication. It's something that we need to get overall better with. After all, most people, like schizophrenics, like Jordan, live their life with this medication is more than a crutch, is a kind of life force.
There have been times in the past when it really seems as though the goal of medicating people with mental illness has had less to do with making sure that they could be optimally effective and independent in their functioning, but has had more to do with keeping them under control or keeping them out of trouble, making sure that that they're not going to be out there in the community causing a disturbance, or maybe in an inpatient institution, making sure that they don't get too loud or obnoxious or disruptive. And the solution, I think, too often in the past has sometimes been, well, let's just give them enough medication that they'll just get real sedated and then we won't have to be bothered with them. And that's certainly, at times, I think, been more for the convenience of the provider, really, than for the convenience of the patient. I don't think that happens as much today as it used to, and I think that most of the time, even people who make mistakes with medications do so with benevolent intentions. I don't think there are a lot of people who are out there just wanting to screw around with folks' lives, but it's a tricky field, and as I said, we don't really know everything we wish we did about which medication is most effective in which situation. And it's certainly very frustrating for a patient and for that person's family to feel like they're being experimented on, but sometimes that's really what has to happen, because trial and error can be the only way that we determine which medication seems to be tolerated the best and seems to be most effective.
You can find more information about CHARGE at charge.org, charg.org. And you can also find information about NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, at nami.org. You can find more about us at denversyntax.com. Music for this episode was provided by the Denver Act, Achille Laurel. You can find them at myspace.com/AchilleLaurel or achillelaurel.bandcamp.com for their newest album, Indiscretions. Cafe au lait.